I'm David Riley. I'm trained as a doctor, a consultant physician, and a GP, and I've been trying to develop a more humane approach to medicine and wondering about how we can explore the human side of care and people's potential for healing. So I'm going to give a talk called Human Healing in the Age of Science, and I'll try and span across a spectrum from people's accounts of their own transformative shifts and relief of their suffering to science and to some public health policy. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for coming. I had a look at people who are here, and I would say that probably all of us are united in a concern of care for other people. And I put up this image of mine, which is a favourite image. Hiya. You're on mute?
Yep.
Oh, my God. that'd be too loud. I've put up this image. For me, it reminds me of core purpose. I'll call it core purpose. And I might ask you to reflect, in a sense, afresh for yourself. What is your core purpose in your work? Why do you do this as opposed to be in industry or manufacturing or the financial sector? What is it that unites us? And something about human beings in restriction, something about human beings in suffering, looking for freedom. And would you be kind enough if you would put up your hand if you would agree with the statement that the human side of care in today's care services is under unacceptable strain. Those of you at the front might not see, but I think it's every hand has gone up. And I'm finding that is the same response in multiple audiences in this country and other countries. Maybe you could call it the conversation of a thousand hands. And it seems to me it's such a pervasive difficulty. It's so dense and challenging that we almost don't speak of it. Well, I'm taking it as if it's the background situation and we just have to deal with it because it's potentially so overwhelming. Let me ask you the simple but important question. Does it matter that those hands went up just now? It does, doesn't it? Deeply. We know that, and sometimes we know it more than we can even articulate it in a way. And we have instinctive understanding of why that's important. And in a way, my purpose was to place that together in front of us and just open a space together in which we acknowledge that and reflect on that. And then, sure, I will wander through some ideas and reflections and bits of science and give you some examples of models of care that we're exploring. But actually, my purpose is a simple one, to reflect on the human side of care and where we've reached and where we might like to go with it. And it's why I now will put a maze across this image to reflect the predicament that we've just put up. And yet, the curious thing is that the human side of care may never have been more needed than now. And I'll try and say why I'm putting that to you. Here's 25 people who are attending the WELL program that I'm going to speak about in the third of three chapters in this talk. A group-based program where people come together to see how they might tackle these challenges to their well-being. And given that, if you look at this list, well, have a look at it and ask yourself, how many of these conditions and difficulties and predicaments are curable? How many of these do you take along to the healthcare system, receive a treatment, and they're cured? I'll settle for one. Yeah? And this is a sobering realization that we are literally at a time of epidemic, and an epidemic of chronic distress and suffering and long-term conditions. If you take the formal label of a long-term condition, the figures vary, but it's certainly at least put as at least a minimum of 1 million people in Scotland. Some would place it at double. And what you'll notice is that if you've got one, you're much more likely to have more than one. And what are we to do about this? And what are we to do about these modern epidemics? In a sense, that's the predicament that I want to present for us collectively in our reflection, but also to mirror the predicament of each one of us or our loved ones and the people in the group which we're facing. What do we do in the face of that circumstance? We're seeking change, obviously. Those individuals on that previous list are very much seeking change, and as we are as a community. And an opening quote, maybe, about creating change from Jane Kelly, the lead artist that I've worked with in creating a new hospital building. First create the conditions to create, and then create. So if we're sitting with this, what I'll just call the predicament, symbolized by that slide of the 25 people, which we'll all understand from our varying perspectives here, I wonder how the conditions are today in our culture to address a change process, some fundamental change process, even, dare I say, a transformative process in the face of these difficulties. I don't know if you've been to your doctor recently. The conditions are not good as we face these epidemics together, as reflected in our hands going up at the beginning. And with over 62% of GP principals asked about holism and their views, they first of all painted for us the picture that they're in of an average of a 9-minute meeting rushed 60% of the time. And I'd ask you for a moment to place yourself in the position of the general practitioner. You're sitting there in those conditions, and in is coming the people on the first slide, the people with the incurable modern epidemics of long-term conditions. And what would you do? How would you cope with that? What would your own well-being be within it, and what actions would you find yourself taking? These doctors told us that over 90% said they felt a holistic approach was essential in good healthcare. But we asked them, do you think you're managing to supply it? What percentage would you guess said yes? What percentage of GPs think they're giving acceptable holistic care? Have a guess and be wrong.
50%.
Okay. So what they told us, it was one in five thought they were managing. And only one in 15 thought the system design would even remotely allow it. And does it matter? They said their main constraints were personal stress and limitation of time. Doctor, we asked, do you ever prescribe, therefore, unnecessarily when you think it would otherwise not be needed? Do you think they would admit to that? It was an anonymized questionnaire. Yeah, we know that. Isn't that interesting? Yeah? It's another one of the big silent, pervading facts. And ask yourself the consequences for individuals and for us culturally of that single line, of the addiction, of the dependency, of the missed opportunity, of the symbolic medicalization, of the side effects. And doctor, do you ever refer on to specialists when you think it otherwise would not have been necessary if these conditions were different? Yes. Again, think of, have you ever met a specialist that didn't have an opinion? Yeah? Or as they would say in Glasgow, want to day something? Yeah? And so the situation becomes more and more complex. And the demand for complementary and alternative medicine, yes. So we have our efforts to help in this new emerging cycle of medicine. And we have these growing consequences of this map. You'll share the concern, I know, of the escalating drug bill, but I don't know if you realise that half of all prescribed drugs are never actually taken. So they end up in the water supply, missing out the middleman, as it were, yeah? And we know the toxic effects on the environment now, indeed, of this. And adverse drug reactions concern us all. The fifth commonest cause of death in America is the administration of a drug while an inpatient in hospital. That's a hard figure to believe, isn't it? That our best efforts to help are actually producing epidemics. And in walks us or our loved one or the patient into the predicament. Oh yeah? Well, I've lost the will to listen. Burnout is absolutely rife. Group of GPs that I'm working with at the moment, even in the last 12 months, out of 14 of them, two have resigned and a third has crashed out from the stress levels. And healthcare workers are now off the commonest of the healthcare sector and off the longest. And the sick lines are now explicitly offering stress as the number one reason. Formerly, it was more hidden behind other labels. And yet, we as healthcare workers, those of us in the situation in this space, we are the ones to whom those patients are coming to say, how might I thrive? How might I approach this life that I'm finding strain in and not coping with? And I'm wondering how we are as teachers and how we are as examples. Doctara, one of the roots of the word doctor, means to teach. Something about having something to offer in that regard. Here's another group of stressed out people. 73% of this group mentioning significant mental health challenges, and at least a third already heading into this cluster of the metabolic syndrome. And the thing is, this is a group of staff joining the staff version of the same program, the WELL program. And what you'll see is that actually it's no different. That we, and that I'm sure will include the people in this space tonight, we are in this together. This idea of the professional and the person who's there to be helped by the professional, and somehow a divide there, I think it's artificial. I think we're in this together. And bear in mind, these are the people who are still working and still managing to be at work. The most recent group of the staff, well, spontaneously, 100% of people, this is a piece of paper they write on before walking into the group-based experience, 100% spontaneously use the word stress out of that group. Yeah, you're too fucked up. Next. Yeah. Maybe you've reached there, and maybe you've experienced it. The ideas, the core ideas of this lecture and the vision that I wanted to share stems from working under the floor. So, particularly in the 80s, I worked for a decade in the pain relief clinic at the Royal Infirmary here in Glasgow. And the challenge as a consultant physician there, the agreement was that I would see people if the clinic was failing to help them. So there had been full investigations, drug usage and procedures. And if that wasn't managing, I agreed to sit with these people. And they became my teachers. And I realized, of course, that my training was completely inadequate and that the toolkit was bust. And what was I to do? And I went back to school in a way. And I asked them if they would become my teachers. And I began to ask them questions, typically just like, what do you think of your care so far? As we took a story together of their journey to date. And they would say things like this. You recognize this? And it's probably got worse. This was 1988. And I began to ask them what would be better, what could have helped, and in particular began to ask them, how have you survived, and how have you got through this? And my orientation began to slowly change in a way that I'll try and describe in a bit more depth, towards tuning in to the answer to those questions. And it began a methodology that has then been developed over these years, which I'll give some examples of, which is working backwards from instances of survival and even thriving in the face of adversity to try and learn from it. Maybe for Star Trek fans, you could call it reverse engineering, but actually working from the phenomenology of survival rather than coming from an a priori theoretical or structured viewpoint to impose on people. And that's central to the information I'd like to share with you tonight. And inherent in our talk this evening and in their predicament and in these conversations was a search for a different way. What are we to do in the face of these long-term conditions? and these levels of stress and so on. Put another way, what would we like to create now? And to speak of change is to speak of creativity. And I don't know about you, but I wasn't trained in creativity. It wasn't even discussed. I used to walk past places called colleges of art and wonder what went on in there, or other realms of life. And yet, inherently, care work and healthcare work and the other forms of care work, we are agents of change. And people are coming to us seeking change. So inherently, we are embedded in creative process. And so the question within the predicament is, what shall we create now? And looking at the, you know, the evolution of ourselves and our culture, I'd like to limit myself to 300 years and do that summarized on one slide with thanks to Andrew Lyne for introducing me to this way of thinking of it. If we think of the last 300 years and the waves of development through the Enlightenment and scientific revolution and birth of the industrial world, and indeed of this part of the world, the birth of the British Empire and onto modernism, as communities, we've worked towards that core purpose of relieving suffering. And we've tried to address it as the ages have changed and the eras have changed. And in this work, co-authored with Andrew and with Phil and others, chose to put it into four big waves. It's arbitrary, it could have been 10 waves. It's more the concept. And the idea of waves of change and creativity, one building on the other, not rejecting the other. And the important thing, I suppose, was responding to what I'm just nicknaming predicament. What were the predicaments in the 1800s? What would be the major epidemics in our country at that time, do you think? What would be the challenge if we were meeting at that time? So infectious diseases, you know, tuberculosis, we'd also be seeing teenage pregnancy rates higher than today, alcoholism and degrees of malnutrition in inner city and so on. But infections predominantly. And then say someone dreamt up Loch Katrin, the clean water supply that helped wipe out the cholera epidemics. But you'll notice I used an odd word. Someone dreamt it up. Change begins in the inner world. Change begins in the daring to form new image and new possibility, which by definition at its moment of germination may not be evidence-based. What is now proven was once only imagined, as William Blake put it. Or as Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge. What does it take to dream up something that says other than, well, cholera is a part of a modern way of life and a result of modernization in cities, and we just need to try and get more workers in the field and more education programs out there. What does it take to think differently and to dream? And the dreams that led to the discovery of the pharmacology in Sarvelson and the first antibiotics and the invention of health visitors. It's funny how it was all made up, and how the professions which seem so solid as if they always existed are actually just imagined and made up. And that we could make up new ones. We could entirely dream to face the epidemics of today as we did collectively after the Second World War and the creation of the NHS. And now as we try in that fourth wave to try and tell people some of the risk factors for disease and advise them how they might change their behavior. Each wave of change is called by diminishing returns from the previous wave. Building a second Loch Katrin will not advance the health of the population. So you build on the shoulders of that wave and you bring in the next wave. What? Being called by the suffering, the diminishing returns, the stress. I put it to you, as I did on that earlier slide, beyond this fourth wave, we now stand in the equivalent of the cholera epidemics. Think again, what are some of today's epidemics in Scotland? You know, based on that slide of the 25 people. depression, diagnosed and much undiagnosed, with 11 to 14% of the Scottish population now on antidepressants, for example, but that perhaps only being the tip of an iceberg of the chronic strain and stress. What are other epidemics? Obesity, you know, now running, 30 to 40%, with two-thirds of us overweight, approaching up to a third of our children overweight, and all of the syndromes which obesity is a marker for. It's not obesity per se that's the problem, it's a marker for. The diabetes now at 5% and using 10% of the NHS budget and so on. You know the figures. And to remind us again, none of these will yield in a transformative way in the foreseeable future to what we're doing. And I put it to you, what we're asking for is a dream of a new Loch Katrin. What would be the equivalent today? Or will we just keep running faster of our current approach and hope that somehow it will move the situation? And so too in a single individual's life. None of this is a criticism of the waves of effort which those patients have put in, or you have put in, or these fantastic technologies and wonderful care that we're giving. This is not a criticism of it. Yet, how do we move it forward? I'm going to offer a quote a couple of times later that we'll explore in a bit more depth, but I'm going to say it's impossible to change the world unless you change your inner map of the world. What is the map? Here's a vision of advancing healthcare, brought out in 1988 for the way forward. You might, if you think about it, spot a common theme in these medicines. Yeah. What is the underlying map? What is the embedded subconscious assumptions that when you go set out to help someone and help the health of a nation, that everything that you dream begins with the word anti? Can you work the map backwards? The map of healing says, in order to help people, you... where's the teaching in giving someone an anti-inflammatory? And where's the empowerment in that? Don't think so. No? So what is the map? This map. That map. No, this map.
It's all being done to people.
It's being done to people. Who has the power in this map? It's external, isn't it? The doctors, and lying behind doctors, the industry and technology and vision and imagination. Again, it's possible you hear this as criticism. It's not intended as criticism. I'm trained in this map and employ it. And it's saving many lives and has done in the world. I'm not knocking that, yeah? We're talking about, nevertheless, the limitations of it. If I could quote Phil, actually, when asked, but what percentage of today's healthcare problems do you think presenting to the whole healthcare system yield to this map? You use it and the problem's dealt with. Guess a percentage. So Phil's figure, I don't know if he still agrees with himself, was about 10 to 15%. But see, if you ask the general public, many will say 85, 95%. And there's actually a detuning between public expectations and vision and our understanding of it. So, we're looking for a fifth wave. And that title came from an earlier paper of about a decade ago, which then set in train some of the thinking which I'd like to expand as I go along. And the people on the Well Programme and those that they represent, if you like, are looking for their own personal fifth wave, as we are as a culture. And I'd like us maybe to dream together around that. And it won't be from our current map. I'm going to suggest the current map might usefully, just for a moment, be brought down to a key question. If we call it the age of intervention, I think the question buried behind it is, what can we do externally as experts to help situations? You could call it the outside in, as you were saying, from the outside. And what might be a question that could be part of the fifth wave? I offer a different image. I don't know if you can see that image. It's a person trying to emerge from a block of stone. Because if the earlier map began ante, you don't really need a PhD to maybe dream, could there be a map that would begin with pro? And I put it to you and then try and illustrate it for you. Maybe the great question here that we could add to the earlier question is, how might this individual or the situation that we're tackling, how might they find their own strength and how might that strength be released, particularly by their own efforts, and then in a sustainable way, a growing sustainable way? Under that floor in that decade, I realized that I had been trained to see people's brokenness. And my job was to ask what's wrong, how can I identify and articulate that, and what can I do to help? And then the shift, my personal shift, would be to begin to see the person's strength. So even if they walk in buried in the concrete and they've lost contact with their own strength, I began to see the strength even as they walked in and sat down. And this shift of vision, map you could call it, of course immediately led to a new journey. Like a sat-nav is actually a mindless thing. It's an automatic mechanism, which, as you know, can take you to crazy places. The subconscious tracking of a map in a human being is just a mechanism, and it takes you only where it can take you. And to change the journey, you have to change the map. And you could see how it would self-generate a new form of interaction if that was the core purpose of the meeting, for example, in my context, between a patient and a doctor. And indeed it did generate different sorts of meetings and different sorts of outcomes and different sorts of vocabulary and inquiry. And it's there that we'll wander into. And to summarize what I'm saying in this first chapter that I would just call the predicament, I'm saying the whole thing is a search for change, and that in balancing the four waves with something new, we have this era of the 300 years and the last 50 with this emphasis on the technical, with the what I'll nickname the tools, the interventions, with a science to match it, a science of numbers, and many different sorts of tools, including as a culture, romancing would be complementary medicines, but often just using them in the same mechanical search for cure as we've used the previous models. And yet somehow, this human side of care, we didn't even have a science of qualities. Well, there's now a beginning of a vocabulary of qualitative inquiry. 10 years ago in healthcare, you wouldn't have heard that word. And as you opened the journals over these 50 years, you would see a lot less of this other side of the coin, of the human side of care. And yet, I'd like to put to you, which I know you understand instinctively, that the transformative change that people are after, particularly in long-term conditions, in that 85% that doesn't yield to the anti-map, the answer actually lies from this side and not here. And we've been running, very imbalanced. Let me put it in metaphor for you. You know, as if we want to create a beautiful work of art and we wonder how we can have this creative process and see it unfold. And we'll wait outside the artist's studio, anxious to learn. And finally the doors open and we burst in past the statue and up to the chisels which made it. And we pick up the chisels and ask what they were made of and if they've been tested in randomized controlled trials and if my chisel's sharper than your chisel. As if the chisel made the statue. But of course, everything on the left and on the right is only the servant. They're just the servants. of what? Back to the core purpose in the center. As Michelangelo said, the statue was already in the stone. It was the artist's job simply to help it be released. And what would happen if we began to embed such a vision in our work, in addition? And that's part of the inquiry. Traditional systems did this, interestingly. In traditional Chinese medicine, the doctor was paid only so long as the patient remained well. All payments ceased on illness, for example, which might be an interesting map to play with. And so I put a blank up, the most important image that I'm using tonight, and that blank page that the individual walks into that one-to-one work with you or into that group or other setting. What is it that's to be created? To try and start to bring it to life a little, here's Mary, whom I saw recently, within the last few months, referred by the rheumatologist to me and in shared care with the pain relief clinic and psychology and a number of two other specialist services. Overwhelming pain has her off work and walking with a stick. And among other difficulties, there's a bone fragment has fractured off her sacrum. She's been had multiple admissions, multiple drugs, and is absolutely stuck. And the very best of care is not managing to move her forward. And more in desperation than in hope, surgeons wondering, is it worth going in to see if they can remove this bony fragment from Mary? And I hold one of these one-to-one meetings, which I'll nickname a therapeutic encounter with Mary, in which the focus isn't on an external intervention, but on that image of the statue and the person emergent from it. And without saying anything that took place in there, here, I think about 4 weeks later, as a short-term follow-up, and in she comes, and what she has to say to me is, I note she looks much better. She walks in without the stick, and she says, that meeting had a massive effect. I left here feeling so good and changed and went home and thought through all we'd gone through, began to review my life, how I'd been behaving and how it wasn't helping me, and seeing things clearer, more realistic, realizing I have to bring some focus on self-care and not just on everybody else. I used to get really stressed around a clean house. Some of you might recognize that. And now I'm not caring about that. I'm just doing what I can do. I've managed to get back to work. I'm more relaxed. The pain's a bit better. I'm moving better. I'm not using crutches. I've noticed that I'm thinking differently about everything. I put this in front of you as an example of what I will call a healing reaction or a healing shift, a transformative movement in a human being. And I see this as a deeply natural, inherent capacity within probably a living organism and certainly within human beings and worthy of study in its own right. And the inquiry that we have called as a team the healing shift inquiry, if I represented it as a germinating seedling to catch a story of the experiences like the lady we've just seen. What we've been trying to do over these many years is listen to and study deeply these accounts of change, these accounts of movement, of healing, of reduction in suffering, and work backwards from that, asking people to tell us, when did this begin? How did it begin? How quickly did it unfold? What stages did it go through? Why do you think it happened? Why was it roadblocked before? What seems to have released it, etc.? Yeah, and trying to use that as a phenomenological core of an inquiry, and then using that information to wonder in this spiral outwards how we can support people to support such reactions within themselves and to become skilled in their self-care in a way that might help germinate and sustain and grow these reactions over months and years. The next layer out on the inquiry with these two hands shaking is what could we as professionals and other carers do to grow knowledge of such phenomena, to be supportive in the meetings that we have, to strengthen individuals in this core task of self-care and of releasing potential within themselves. And we've developed some education programs around that and have been taking multidisciplinary teams through that, and that's part of our evaluation. And if I move out to these multiple hands shaking here, that would represent the group-based work, which in 2004 we'd started to try and scale up to ask, could you take this knowledge from the core inquiry and see if it could be brought into a group circumstance? And from there, the fifth wave I've put up is the idea of being part of policy discussion and cultural shift. And that those outer layers take us to the sister inquiry, as we've called it, led by Phil, on the cultural well-being, cultural influences on well-being in Scotland, the After Now project. And at the end, I could give you web links to these projects. And collectively, therefore, this we've nicknamed the Healing Shift Inquiry, seeing itself as moving and concerning itself across these layers and these scales. And central to it is a study of human emergence then, as the lady who's just spoken to us has said. This movement from suffering and towards degrees of recovery and release and onwards in towards well-being and flourishing and indeed transformation of some type. And the inquiry would also need to concern itself with an understanding and an eye for the opposite process in human beings, so that we would just not be making technical diagnoses of people and situations. We would be asking, where are they on these cycles? And to be attuning our engagement according to where they were within the stages of these cycles. It will take multiple language for sure, this inquiry. And that no one has a monopoly on it. Some of it may, if we could to any degree, is going backwards into the deep knowledge within human beings of what healing is. This is from Chauvet, the French cave that you may be aware of. This is this artwork is 32,000 years old, and busting the idea that art evolved in a way from a crude to a developed level and showing levels of beauty and genius and sensitivity that are hardly matched today. When Picasso saw work like this, he came out and drew the conclusion, we have learned nothing from it. And the images in this cave seem to be embedded in shamanistic tradition, in the whole question of the inner world of a human being versus their outer life, and how are they mediated and bridged. So undoubtedly there are deep traditions which could help us in that way. I had another little quote. I'd just like to say to the technician, I might be coming up to a sound quote in a moment, and do you think that'll be live? But if we look at those deep images, let's look at some of our contemporary deep images of this transformation of inner world. Here are brain scans of people being subjected experimentally to physically induced pain, from heat up to the level of pain, and you'll see the various systems activate. These are systems activating to hallucinated pain. Not simply imagined pain, which hardly activated the system, but taking the person into a journey which activates the world of imagination very deeply and of the senses in a hypnotically induced state. And in this, as you can see, all reported heat sensations and five developed pain. The inner life. And where else does suffering live, actually? Where else is life experienced? And what is our core purpose but to work with individuals in terms of their experience of life, which, of course, is only within individual subjective inner world consciousness? The subjective world, which has tended to be sidelined in the inquiry into the third-person objective mapping of the world. Other languages we'll need to get comfortable with, and they're not...
And now I can see it's closing down. Now you've got a scan, it's obvious. So now
Another word, healing, is awkward and can be used elsewhere in ways that may raise antibodies. But what I'm referring to here is that when you cut yourself, the body heals. When you have a broken heart, it tries to mend. And the organisms move towards wholeness and restoration. And we know from the placebo studies now, this is dopamine-releasing, drug-releasing dopamine for people with Parkinson's disease. Yet, so do does placebo injections. Strong, inherent, powerful healing and self-destructive systems are present in the human body, deeply wired with the consciousness, the inner and outer culture, and the embedded maps within individuals. New words are being invented to join up the different systems of the body that the Victorians started to separate, as we see the inner world right itself into the physical health. 300 studies over 30 years concluding, for example, stress alters immunity. We just have to move away from the idea of head doctors and body doctors and people separate in these dimensions. Here's emotion of gratitude or warmth causing a coherent pattern in the heart's speed. Here's frustration speaking for itself, like a drumbeat being written into the body second by second, even down into the lymph nodes and the immune system. Many languages we can look at. Here's a scientific study again on how antidepressants, when they work, wake up the left prefrontal cortex of a human being. But so too did placebo in a significant number of people in this double-blind study. Think of those 14% on the antidepressants and those rush GPs and wonder. Human beings are capable of waking up their own antidepressant center. But what would it take? What would it take to teach people and to explore this as a culture? Into the scanner went someone who'd had at least 10,000 hours of training of their own mind. And when asked to meditate, could consciously and at will, within 60 seconds, wake up the left prefrontal cortex. And he did so with the meditation on compassion, for example. Here, by the way, is a way to improve your own health and your client's time and get paid for it. Yeah, by the practitioner restoring their core compassion in their practice. The person that benefits most is the practitioner, more than the recipient of the compassion. And the positive physiology of compassion is now self-evident in the research. And a key to this, then, is the practitioner. If we're going to work in a shift way, and your health and your well-being, and I wonder how you are. I wonder what you would write on your piece of paper before one of these programs. Thich Nhat Hanh was asked the difference between illness and wellness, and he wrote the two words and circled these letters. And the quality of the engagement, the human engagement, is just so much more fundamental than it's nice to be nice. It turns out it's the key that unlocks the potential in the encounter. We now know that, for example, an experience of empathy by an individual in a healthcare encounter doesn't guarantee enablement, meaning a code for a spark registered in this questionnaire that I feel more able to help myself, to understand, to move my life forward. What the studies have shown is that it's a precondition. In the early work that we did with Stuart Mercer, that would then be part of the foundation work of the CARE score that's now in widespread use, not a single people in the first 200 that we studied had reported a high enablement score if they had a low empathy score, a low experienced empathy with the practitioner. If you walk out of that meeting and you do not feel the individual was authentic, present, and genuinely caring, you can forget it. That's what the research is showing. And Stuart has now confirmed this in over 8,000 cases throughout Scotland, independent of morbidity, independent of deprivation index. This is one of the key active ingredients. You are. Even studies are showing, for example, in the management of diabetes, with the higher empathy experience score, you get better control on the HbA1c and the blood lipids compared to low experienced empathy. We all put up our hands at the beginning. We knew it was important. It's probably more important than we even dare to imagine. And the power that's available to us through our humanity and through the meetings and engagements that we have with people is probably almost unimaginable. And somehow we may be fundamentally missing the point. And as the encounter grows and the compassion deepens, it turns out that even good practices of different types can train ourselves in compassion. For example, this is the brain activity in novices not trained in compassion as they're played tapes of another human being who's been in pain of some type, and they watch the brain scan. Here's the brain activity in people with trained compassion. Because you know it's often said, yeah, but surely people are just born with it, or it's a natural, or not. And what if those in healthcare work don't have it, or other caring work? Actually, it's a practice. It's a practice like playing a musical instrument that, of course, would take 10,000 hours for maybe the deepest mastery. But a few hours is already a very rich beginning in that. And the meeting between us, it turns out the ECG, my heart tracing, is so strong that if you're within a few feet of me, or I touch you especially, my ECG can be read in your brain scan. The meeting is physical as much as it's psychological. We are reading one another, and it would appear that we have biological and basic animal instincts that allow us to read these things. A bit like Monty Roberts' work with the horses. You know the join-up between the human and the horse? When they're joined, as the human makes the movement, the horse will move with them. This is what I observe in encounters between us as human beings. Healing space is a reality, if you like, as an experience for people in this inner world. And even the quality of the physical space has been shown in research to help the healing. This is the unit that we designed as an example of a healing environment, inspired by places like this. This, believe it or not, is a hospital in Glasgow and not a prison. Is this procedure still experimental, doctor? Because when it was all just down to the science and the intervention and the experts, well, what did it matter how beautiful the environment was or how deeply relaxed the individual was or the depth of trust? I'll just decide what's wrong with you in a paternalistic way. I'll give you the medicine that will fix you. And we were wrong. It's okay to admit it. We were wrong in some way. And I think we need to fundamentally rethink. Skipping the details of this, just to say in audits that we've done, it looks like bring up the emphasis on the human engagement and process, and you can break some of these cycles, escalating cycles of prescribing and cost. In the final short chapter now, I'd like to speak of an experiment beginning in 2004, asking, could we scale up the year's work before then, the many years of work, into a group setting, into a group program called the Wellness Enhancement Learning Program. And tell you something of the experiment, which is ongoing. And the basic core of it, which I'll talk about, is 4 half-days, which up in Nairn, who are also working with another group, an optional fifth day, in which people are shown the same slides as you've been shown and taken more deeply and interactively into that dialogue and are confronted with the predicament and presented with their own challenge as to how they might meet it. And so absolutely central is what I've put here of the activation of a sustaining transformation in self-care, rather than a toolbox. But in support of that change, examples of self-care practices are taught, such as meditation, mindfulness, cognitive skills, better ways to feed yourself, and so on. But the toolkit's not the issue. A different toolkit could have been chosen. And let's be honest, two of us here probably doesn't have some self-help books at home on the shelf and can't get information off the internet. And information doesn't make change. It's not sufficient to spark the change process. So the emphasis in this journey is on the change process rather than on the outer toolkit. In Glasgow, which I won't speak of, there's other modules which are being explored. And as I was saying, and just as a reminder, the journey is the creative one of the predicament and of the maps which guide it. Now, the map might sound like a psychological concept or a theoretical construct, but actually it's a physical reality. It's impossible to think any thought amongst the trillion of our neurons without in real time there being physical wiring occurring in the brain. Now, that occurs so fast we can't imagine it. But here's a picture of those first tentative connections between two neurons as a thought is thought for the very first time, the novel thought. And we used to think that, as you know, you were born with so many neurons and then they progressively died off. And then it was discovered that even in our 80s and 90s, we're generating up to tens of thousands of brand new brain cells per day. Some of the earlier studies of this were in the taxi drivers in London, the before and after studies, where the hippocampus expanded and there was remodeling of brain. And we now realize that the brain is a dynamic, growing, remodeling system. And that when we first think, dare to imagine Lockatrin, or what will be our equivalent Lockatrin, small tentative mappings open. Or when that despairing patient in darkness has the possibility of saying, do you mean I've got some ability? Do you mean I could make a change here, even though there isn't a cure or a medical treatment? That begins the spark process, but to build it will take time. And the more a thought is worked, or a pattern lived of behavior, the body lays down these layers that you can see here in cross-section of myelin. And after weeks to months of what the literature calls deep practice of something new, there'll be 30 to 50 layers. And the brain will be thinking this pathway approximately 3,000 times faster than the first time the thought was made. So the change that we're up against in ourselves are perhaps decades or generations of embedded maps versus the tentative birth of a new way of perceiving or a new way of living. And we as practitioners need to understand the challenge of that and go well beyond just telling people you need to change in some way. And I think there's questions for this at every level. As George Bernard Shaw says, if you can't, you know, you can't change anything unless you can change your mind. And so it's not the what of change, it's the why. And what people are brought up against is this issue of why bother making a change in your self-care? Why bother starting this long journey, the equivalent of learning a musical instrument in the face of your old patterns and behaviors, and what will it change? And metaphor is used in these dialogues because the pre-verbal mind thinks in images and pictures. And this is where the maps lie. Let me ask you just to illustrate it very quickly and simply. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to generate an image that reflects your own well-being, your own state of well-being. And I'd like to ask you this. If you were a plant, what shape are you in? Okay, you've got an image, yes? And could the plant be in better shape, would you say, looking at it? Okay. And ask yourself, what does it need from you? Go inwards just for a second and go quiet and see if anything arises personal for you. What is it asking for from you? In this personal entry into inner space and a silent listening is very central in change process. And now let me ask you this. Who is the gardener of this plant? Maybe you could answer out loud. Who is the gardener? Whose plant is it? Yeah? Give yourself a gardening score out of 10. Put your hand up if it could be better. Have a look round. Yeah? It's only in a shift of realization when the heart is engaged with the head and the left with the right brain and all the other intelligences that you'll see these full potentials move and unfold. And these are very accessible and understandable, but like studying music or any other creative process, it requires to be studied, considered, and practiced. It won't just happen. But my understanding is it's quite predictable. Given a dialogue as you've just had, but in much more depth and with more time, sure, people are then presented with information like, I won't animate it, you know, the spreading obesity epidemic or the stress epidemic, the drug use epidemic, but they're now personally, internally processing it. Where am I in relation to this as a gardener, and where would the strength come from, and where will the transformation occur? And the realization is not going to come externally, actually. This is not an instead of public health discussion. Can I emphasize that? If water supplies are poisoned and children are being born into poverty and the conditions are toxic, let's work as we must. But let's not abandon either the inherent potential for transformation within the individuals in those conditions. This need not be an either-or conversation. This is just a wee slide about diets from the course. People are not told to go on any diet. They're recommended just to eat food rather than processed product. And they're taken on a journey I'm now not going to go into, just to give you a sense over the 12 or 16 hours of journey. Finally, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the beginning of evaluation of this more formally. As the years have passed, we've been tuning up and continuously adjusting and learning cycles the course, and people have been giving us fantastic feedback, telling us where we should be going and what we should be doing with this. Everybody should be doing this. It should be in schools. One mum paid her teenage son a fiver to watch one of the videos of the course to help transform his own self-care. And we've been through two phases of formal evaluation. The early one tracked people with chronic fatigue, ME, and this is over 9 months. I just present these as quick sketches. This is successful enablement of spark, high levels of enablement, sustaining themselves across the 9 months, improving fatigue levels, rising forms of physical function, and gradual improvements in the main complaint over the 9 months, more rapid improvements in well-being and coping. And currently, we are in phase two of evaluation with a wonderful team working there with a very mixed set of methodologies, of questionnaires, of in-depth qualitative interviews, and of pilot tracking of biological measures, and working with many partners, too many to mention. And in maybe the just 3 to 4 minutes, I'd just like to give you a wee feel for things that we're finding. This is 1.5 years follow-up. I won't go into the details, but as you can see, these are people principally with chronic fatigue syndrome. We do seem to at least be on the trail of the vision of the possibility of sparking, sustaining, self-sustaining, and progressive growth process in self-care. And I present this as very early work, as a simple modeling, not the way or the best way. And we would care to see ourselves only as part of a broader inquiry, like one bud on a tree. And I'm sure many of us here are doing similar work. We're progressively following a number of cohorts now in 3 health boards regions of the country. This would be one of those staff groups, having just the same sort of response as the previous patients. We don't need to read it all, but just you know, invaluable to keep me well, great to work with patients, change the lives of my family, causing me to think differently and perceive patients differently. And the prospect of cohorts now, again, early results just coming in, rising, coping in everyday living, rises in self-compassion over this is a 9-month follow-up, dropping fatigue levels, rising psychological well-being. And interestingly, in terms of biological parameters, fasting insulin levels, which rise with stress and processed food, the average being 5, above 7, you're suspicious of pre-diabetes, and above 10, you are pre-diabetic. It's thought 10% of people in Scotland are probably pre-diabetic, from a 2009 paper from the British Diabetic Association. We are finding, this is staff, 37% are pre-diabetic, which is quite breathtaking as we look at the future epidemics. And in fact, diabetic and pre-diabetic from 106 people so far, running at quite alarming levels. And yet, you can drop your insulin levels within 48 hours of dropping processed food. I'm not going to say any more about that, other than that people who've been presented with the issue of self-gardening and then given some information would appear, even in that short intervention, to be sparked into change. We've similarly been tracking omega-3 to omega-6 ratios. The more omega-3, the better it looks in terms of heart disease. And ideally, you should have maybe double omega-3 to omega-6. But UK guidelines say at least try and get 40% of your omega acids as omega-3. Well, and what have we found? We found that 6% of these cohorts reach 40% and no one over 42%. He chose not to do pre-course questionnaires, but he did have his bloods checked. He's pretty maxed out on the drugs to try and cope with this problem. He thinks of it before the course as being probably genetic, but he's aware, in looking back in an interview at 3 months, that, you know, he would just sit in the front of the telly and eat his crisps. 3 months after joining such a program, you can see what happened: dramatic weight loss, rowing, beginning to reduce his drugs, understanding his illness, feeling in control, completely changing. Objective parameters, the fasting insulin at unbelievably high levels, beginning to drop, the omega-3s rising towards the 40% threshold within 3 months. And let's have a wee...
And also, I have a tool which I thought was quite powerful, which was then given to the man. Because before that, he was talking about ego and anatomy. He was before, but nobody ever said, what you need to do is change your diet. You shouldn't be on a diet, you should be on a different diet. And this is why you have a different diet. And that came through, I thought, very clearly. Slightly, I would say for somebody like me with diabetes, it could do with a diet. You should also say, if you have not spent any diabetes, then that is all important. It's not everything, but certainly it's one of them. And the concept of that was saying, change the plan, go on the diet, go on the way, come off the diet, the idea of this is how you manage it. You need to go to a different level. It just got me achieving that. That's so simple, but in the same time, it's incredibly hard because in explaining that, certainly for me, it would be a way to control, to feel it.
And finally, Brian, through an accident off work, using his sticks, chronic pain, fatigue and depression, really struggling, having to take a day at a time, and has become a recluse, as you can see. He's just caught in the web of things and debilitated. Without getting into details of this, is just to show very high drug, on 11 drugs, low self-compassion, pain, negativity, and struggle. His three-month interview, this is what he told us about. Same sort of story. I hope maybe bringing to life the place where I was starting, about the possibility of transformation, about what could happen when we focus on the inherent strength and capacity within an individual. And I'd like to just finish with Brian's own words again. Brian will refer to the dog and the plant. That's the metaphoric discussion I had with you about your own plant, yeah? So that's where he's coming from.
I'm not going to have this anymore. I'm taking 4 years, I think I'm taking a step back. And sometimes I feel like I've stopped myself and rethink things over and maybe address things, you know.
You've noticed that in yourself?
I've noticed that I'm doing that. I'm like more aware.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking more. So it's really setting me to think more about that. And so, yeah, it's so, all right.
And finally, we had a visit from an external team. Oops. We had a visit from an external team in January who met with half of the people who'd been through the program to date. And this was from Phil and his team. And self-evidence. Embodied shifts is what they described. Time doesn't permit me to show you the full analysis that they offered of this, but this is available on the website. And I'll just finish with the closing quote of their report. Thank you very much. Okay.